This is Stephen Gregory. I am sitting in the home of Stanley Rosen. Stanley, it's good to be here.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to have you.
Stanley, you studied with Professor Strauss. When did you first begin studying with Strauss?
1948.
Would that have been at the New School?
No, it would have been at the University of Chicago in the college.
I see. Okay, 1948. You must have been one of his very first students.
I was, actually. I mean, there were some students in New York whom I didn't know. They were older than I. People like Harry Jaffa and Joe Cropsey. But of the Chicago generations, I was one of the very first. Strauss and I met through the mediation of his son, Walter. And he had just come to Chicago. And I had a long conversation with him, lasted a couple of hours. And he was kind enough to invite me to become a student of his. He had just come to town, so to speak, and didn't have the large following that soon was to be his destiny. I was unable to accept his offer at the time because I had already started the process of going to the New School. But after a few weeks there, I realized I was in the wrong place and left school, worked for a while, and then got back into Chicago as quickly as possible, where I stayed for 5 years.
So you had met Strauss's son, and he interested you in his father, whom you had not heard of before?
Never heard of him.
I see.
I could tell you the entire roster of the Cleveland Indians baseball team, but never heard of professors and philosophers. But Strauss saw something and got me into Chicago, and he backed me all the way. I was always a bit heterodox, but that didn't matter much to him. If I may tell a very quick little story, which was told to me by Peter H. von Blankenhagen, a friend of Strauss's. Von Blankenhagen said at the party to me, after a few drinks, he said, "You know, Stanley, I have to tell you that I didn't like you when you came to Chicago. I was a bit uncouth." And whenever I would mention this to Strauss, he always replied, as of me, "He's getting better." So my career owes itself, such as it is, to the indifference of a truly unique intelligence, namely Strauss's, the indifference to high society or academic society. He wanted the goods, so to speak, and I'll always honor him for that.
When you say he wanted the goods, what was he looking for in a student?
Well, I mean, since Alan Bloom and I were two of his closest students, it's hard to say. I mean, some of his students were dressed up from outfits from Brooks Brothers and, you know, looked like English dukes. And the rest of us looked like disheveled lower middle class Jews from New York. I was, I thought, superior to all of them because I came from Cleveland. That allowed me to remove the distance between these various ethnic and philosophical movements. Well, he looked for intelligence. I think that should be without saying. He looked for intelligence. And he looked for a kind of decency, in which the person who was working with him, studying with him, was given every opportunity to progress in his own philosophical studies, amateurish though they might be. This is an interesting point. I'll just expand on it for a minute, if I may. So he wanted a decency in the sense of a respect for the text. If the authors of the great texts in the history of philosophy were worth studying at all, then they were worth studying as exhaustively as possible. Too many professors would say things like, "My view on the truth is such and so. I differ from Kant in the following 6 points." I mean, this sounds informal, but it's a characteristic model for discussions in philosophy at conventions, contemporary conventions, reading of papers. Strauss wanted us to see that the texts had to be mastered, if I can put it that way. You had to know them because they were the foundation of everything, the texts being the Greek philosophers, Greek thinkers. That requires a certain decency. You must never be so proud of your own prowess, your own technical prowess in particular, that you come to believe that what you have to say is more important than what Kant or Hegel said. Now, that's not an easy point to understand, and it may even be partly wrong. That is to say, if you're going to be respectful to the great members of the tradition, won't you end up in being a mere disciple or a mere slave? How can you retain your integrity and the integrity of the text at the same time? Strauss was looking for people who had a kind of sobriety and, in that sense, decency, who were able to put their full energy, their focus, onto the task of illuminating the text. notice that I haven't been talking about not drinking too many alcoholic beverages, not carrying on with your neighbor's wife, and so on. But those things are all secondary. And to make a point from the ancients that I, of course, first heard from Strauss, for the Platonic philosopher, and that's what Strauss was trying to represent, for the Platonic philosopher, the family is secondary. That's something that's very hard for modern men to appreciate. It's not easy to honor when one is living in the modern epoch. But I think there can be no question. I mean, since we're interested in Leo Strauss's views, I heard him say directly in one of his seminars on Plato that he himself had no doubt that for Plato, romantic love was silly, childish. Now, as one who was in love and had been so on more than one occasion, I started out in my studies with Strauss with a prejudice. But he sort of set me straight in the sense that he wanted me to understand that if you come to the point where you're trying to do something that you can't do, then you are not being a decent man in the sense that I use the word. Well, is that too complicated?
No.
Okay.
I'm thinking of the virtue probity as you're speaking.
Mm-hmm. I'm not, unfortunately.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So Strauss was looking for a certain kind of decency, a sobriety in his students, as well as, of course, high intelligence.
Right. He wanted theory and practice to be attended to. Practice may or may not be as easy as theory to disseminate, but in the domain of political thought, in order to succeed, one has to be sensible. And being sensible means something very close to what I assume you mean by probity. For example, Strauss used to quote very frequently a passage from Perry Mason, one of his favorite authors. And he said that Perry Mason, I didn't read that particular Perry Mason novel, so I can't cite it. But the man who wrote the books, Earl Stanley Gardner, says of his leading character, Perry Mason, he was sharp as a razor and clean as a hound's tooth. You ever hear that?
Yes.
I think it's famous in Strauss circles.
Well, I don't know about that, but I read Earl Stanley Gardner separate from
So I wanted to be sure that my remark in answer to your question
yes.
was not too pious. In other words, probity is a faculty for seeing things in their sharpness and in their detail. It's an open question whether that's a moral.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah. For Strauss, it was not. It was something different. Well, we can summarize this. If you want to know about Strauss as a teacher of young people, Strauss wanted people who would create the political circumstances that would make philosophy itself more secure. That's what he wanted.
It's been said that in his teaching at Chicago, he emphasized the moral teaching in philosophical texts in his classroom teaching. Does that sound recognizable to you?
Yeah, I mean, the whole business, which we haven't mentioned so far in your visit, the whole business of esotericism comes into play here. I don't want to develop it in one long speech. You can articulate it for us.
Well, it's been said that in his teaching of philosophical texts at Chicago, that he often emphasized the moral teaching.
Yeah, because theoretical teaching is useless, literally useless for Aristotle. It's not a practical activity at all. Politics is a practical activity. So the question of esotericism, which strikes our contemporaries as so odd, simply means that human beings with any real cleverness for managing the affairs of their fellow human beings must do so cautiously. I mean, every sane person would grant that. I sometimes say this and people are shocked. I said, Strauss's doctrine of esotericism was childishly simple. Anybody who, like myself, grew up on the ghetto streets of Cleveland, Ohio, would never take it seriously at all, John Rawls, or, you know, I mean, it just couldn't be done because it has nothing to do with politics or, for that matter, with reason. So, yes, Strauss emphasized the practical. Here's how Strauss taught. Let's cut to the quick. I went to visit Strauss on another or the same visit that I recounted before.
Around 1971 or 72 at St. John's?
Yeah, something like that. The way the question seems to be formulated today is that it's immoral to keep anything from anyone about anything. And Strauss pointed out always that if you did that, you would level society to the point at which freedom itself would be impossible. What we would call great works of art would cease to exist. Scientific enterprises would cease to exist. I think that's going to happen, by the way. Let me know if it does. I mean, I'll be dead by then. But it'd be interesting to have this conjecture activated. So, go carry on.
Well, you brought up the issue of esotericism in connection with Strauss's teaching, and I'd asked you about the practical or moral side of his teaching, and that led you to the reflection on esotericism. And was Strauss practicing the simple principle of esotericism in his teaching?
I think he was at points.
Yes.
I mean, the fact that Strauss could be misunderstood to be religious or a rabbi, practically a rabbi. I mean, when Dick Kennington was working on Descartes in the Committee on Social Thought, and he gave a very interesting paper on Descartes. I was quite young, even, you know, even for a college student at the time, but I was fascinated by his claim that Descartes did not believe in God. Strauss said to me, "Philosophers are paid not to believe." I always remember that. I'm giving you all my material from the essay I've written on Strauss in Chicago. But in any event, that's the point. Of course the wise men, whether they were ancients or futurists, of course they practiced esotericism. It would be insane not to.
There's a letter from Strauss to Klein around 1949. This would have been around the time he got his appointment to Chicago, in which he complains to Klein that students need a political teaching. He has to come up with a political teaching. My understanding is it doesn't necessarily mean party politics, but did you have the sense when you were a student that he had a teaching that he was deploying for the sake of his students?
Yes, I did. It's fairly clear to me. Don't ask me to demonstrate it.
Sure.
Strauss believed that politics, political wisdom, was in one sense relative to theoretical wisdom, but in another sense had to be worked out so that people could be free to engage in theory. You know that from Aristotle. People must be freed to engage in theory. If they can't do that, if they don't have that capacity, then philosophy will perish. That's almost happened in our own time. I mean, this insane obsession with brain waves. You know, you're regarded as illiterate at the American Philosophical Association if you can't cite the experts on cybernetics and brain surgery. That's the end of philosophy when that takes over. And we're just a hop, skip, and a jump from that. Did Strauss know this? I once had a talk with him, I'll quote that, in which he and I were alone in his office, and we were talking about this very subject. And I asked him, "What is your plan for political society?" Something like that. I'm not even sure that I was as explicit as I just was with you. But in this conversation, Strauss said very clearly and explicitly that his purpose politically was to formulate a teaching that would make political activity safe for philosophy. Now, that means no public speech. You know, lots of things which I love. I mean, how could I tell my jokes if there were no public speech? There was no mystery about the secret teaching. Only fools. There were, you know, third-rate students of Strauss. Various places around the country regard themselves as wise men. And they walk around chuckling, you know, their eyes twinkling. In the old days, they had a pipe that was part of their tools. And they would also stop periodically in the walk and say, "Yeah, yeah." This is a kind of base, you know, imitation of what it is to be a philosopher. But that's what most people know about philosophy. Yes, Strauss had in mind the formulation of a political teaching, one which drew heavily on Aristotle and Locke. Well, I'm sure he liked Rousseau more than Locke. Who could fail to like Rousseau more than Locke? But that's not the question. The question is what works politically. And Rousseau contributed to the line of which perhaps Nietzsche was the next member. And they destroyed the modern civilization. I'm far more interested in Nietzsche, Heidegger, Kojève, others of that sort. Did you ever hear or see it written? Strauss was talking himself about his youth. He said he and Klein, his best friend, would go to a cafe where intellectuals gathered, and they would be quiet for a few minutes, and then suddenly they would yell to each other across the room, "Nietzsche! Heidegger!" That's a sign of certain playfulness, but it's not all playfulness. Strauss himself, I'm quite sure, preferred to read Heidegger than John Locke. I hope that doesn't strike you as blasphemy.
In Strauss's teaching in the classroom,
yeah,
I'm not aware of him ever teaching Heidegger, and I've heard that he never referred to him.
That's almost true. It was true when I, for example, got there
Well, if Heidegger was most interesting and perhaps most important, why didn't Strauss teach Heidegger? Or why didn't he discuss it more openly?
Yeah, he thought it was too dangerous. Mm-hmm. Don't blame me for that. I mean, that was his view. He never taught Heidegger and never mentioned his name until approximately mid-1950s. So I think Strauss was partly amazed at the great popularity. I think he tried to get it without thinking he'd have any great luck. But he got it. Perhaps your very presence here is a powerful example of the fact that Strauss retains all of his charisma and attractiveness to young people. What do you think? I mean, you're probably closer to this than I am.
Well, I think the remarkable thing we've seen in the last decade are a number of serious scholars around the world who never studied with a student of Strauss who are now doing interesting work on Strauss's thought. Strauss's thought has become a subject of study, and that Strauss is being treated as a thinker in his own right, apart from any movement. These individuals, primarily in Europe, also in China, are coming to him independently.
Esotericism is here. Does that constitute success?
Well, I understood you to say that his success was linked to his practice of esotericism and his giving his students a teaching.
That's correct. That's part of his hermeneutical program.
Let me back away from these heights just for a minute. You saw Strauss at the very beginning of his teaching career at Chicago, I mean.
Yeah.
And there's a story told that when he came to give a job talk, that there was a university historian who was reported to have said, "This man will be a researcher, but he'll never be a teacher." And was the Strauss that you knew in 48 and 49 an effective teacher? Or is this something he learned over the course of his time at Chicago?
Well, I'm not sure that I can give you the final answer on that. But I can tell you that I had only to be in Strauss's presence for 15 minutes in order to know who he was and what I was dealing with. He was the first genuinely intelligent man. I'm not talking about mathematical logicians now, you know, but this sort of thing. He was the first and most intelligent man that I met as a teacher of philosophy. First of all, he knew everything. I mean, that's the way it looked to us. He knew everything. Secondly, he could answer every question that was put to him. The guys in the philosophy department neither knew nor could they invent. They were simply, well, you're not Jewish, obviously, but they were flukken. That's a nice Jewish word. It means beasts of the fields, something like that. No, I knew that immediately.
Particularly in the early years at Chicago, but for, I think, at least a decade, he was known for having his classes run an hour or 2 hours over.
That's right.
And Strauss, obviously, in that time, was just pouring himself into his teaching. I mean, spending 4 hours in it with a class answering every question that came up. Why do you think he did that?
I can answer that question. I don't know if you'll like it. Strauss was very timid. And his courses were given at that time, you know, in the mall, on 62nd Street or 63rd Street. It was a rough neighborhood. And he always arranged to have some big graduate student walk him home. I was told this by people who were much closer to him than I was. So I meant that seriously. I mean, I can't tell you that it's true.
Well, he could have ended the class on time and had a graduate student walk him home.
He could have. He could have done several things. He could have quit the teaching business at 3 o'clock and gone home. Of course, the weather was bad in Chicago in the winter. So in any event, if you're asking me, was the delay or the extension of his...
Was there an intention behind it? Was he trying to do something?
I never thought of it. I thought of it as a man who loved to talk. Strauss got carried away by with a genuine enthusiasm for talking. We were talking of him as some kind of super genius. One limitation he had was that he was as naive as a child. And it was very charming. I mean, it was part of his erotic technique, if I can put it that way. It was part of his erotic technique. And it certainly never fooled me because I'd been publishing poetry on Eros, you know, from the time I was 10 years old. But there is no question that that's what he was doing there. He was carried away. Strauss had the great difficulty to face. That is that he knew that philosophy was superior to poetry. And he, in fact, had very little poetry gift in the original sense of poetry. I think he was working to succeed in developing this cadre of political apparatchiks that we were alluding to a little bit ago. And I think that it did not work. I can assure you that I'm giving you a more accurate picture of Strauss than others I could name. But he was really just so sly And at the same time, he was like a child. He was very impressed by America when he came to America. He told us one night at his home, he'd been in town just for a couple of months. He said, America, wonderful country. He said, in America, people who buy newspapers leave the change on the coin thing. He said, that's amazing. He said, such honesty, such virtue. It could never happen in Europe. He left the money on the tray. People would take it away immediately. That was one of his best, very, very fine men. So excellent teacher from the very beginning. Incredible knowledge. A man who could convert the most diverse kinds of people. As I say, I thought I was smarter than Strauss. 3 months later, I certainly no longer had that view. He used to tell us regularly. He'd say, I'm not a philosopher. I've sat in the room many times when he said this. I'm not a philosopher. I'm only a student of philosophy. No, he wasn't kidding. He was not a philosopher in his sense of the word. I mean, who were the philosophers? Locke, Leibniz, you know, the names that recurred frequently. Those names. He didn't regard himself as anywhere near in that category. And he made that absolutely clear for the 20 years that I knew him.
How do you understand this combination in Strauss of childlike naivete and wiliness?
I don't know. We have to start from the data. As Sherlock Holmes said in another passage that Strauss and I both shared a liking for, Watson says, what's going on here is Holmes. And Holmes says, Mr. Watson, he says, data, I must have data. How did he put it? You can't draw blood without, I don't know, you know, the fancy passage Strauss used to quote for fairly regularly. I don't know that he succeeded in it, but that's what he was up to.
You made the striking observation that Strauss combined childlike naivete and wiliness. To say he was so wily, you don't know what to think of him month to month. And I'm just asking you to reflect on that for one more moment, how those things could be combined in Strauss. They seem to be opposites.
Yeah, but you know, if you knew a lot of the German and European in general expatriate scholars and thinkers and artists, that was very common. I mean, they were sophisticated in some ways. But many of them were naive people without clear political views. I think that Strauss had to have everything restated in a philosophical way for the thing to make any sense to him. I would say also that naivete and theoretical brilliance are not separated opposites at all. Mm-hmm. I think they go well together. I would even go so far to say that practical philosophy, when understood properly, is theoretical philosophy. But don't quote me. I don't like that formulation. So, an absolutely remarkable man. What I learned from Strauss can't be learned by going to school and reading his books. I mean, it set me straight. You know that famous story of Kant writes in one of his letters or one of his essays. He said, when I was a young man, I revered David Hume, or words to that effect. David Hume was number one on the hit parade. But as I grew older, I came to see that it was not that at all, but I suddenly lost the word that it is. It's virtue. It's virtue. Well, I've been trying very hard in the last 20 minutes to assure you that my admiration for Strauss, in one way, knows no bounds.
Okay, well, I will take you to another track, but let me just return to one other thing, which is, I believe you that Strauss's self-understanding was that he was not a philosopher.
Yeah.
Do you think he was right?
No. I mean, if you ask me, do I think that Strauss was Leibniz? The answer would be no. In other words, Strauss devoted his life to the study of the history of philosophy, namely other men's books, because their books were better than his books. Or they taught him something that he needed to know. I mean, he also, of course, criticized very sharply. Nobody could be a scholar and never say anything bad about his teachers or his colleagues without going crazy. We all have these grandiose notions. We're better than our teachers. Heidegger mentions it, but you don't need Heidegger to tell it to you. It's quite clear. Nietzsche has very nice paragraphs on that. The best thing that a teacher can do for his students is to kill him or to cut the umbilical cord, which is a slightly different variation on the story. No, I think that this business about there being 12 philosophers in the history of the world, that's romanticism, in my opinion. If you say, well, there are 2,500 members of the American Philosophical Association, that's the answer, that's how many philosophers there are. You know, unless, God forbid, some of them have died in the last second, they're all philosophers. I mean, that's their PhD, their specialty, their articles. Well, of course they're philosophers. You would be regarded as fantastically rude to make this point at a professional convention. Strauss made it regularly in public. And that appealed to my arrogance. One of the things I liked about Strauss is that he was very arrogant. I mean, he would spend 2 hours giving a lecture on modesty and prudence and so forth. And he would say to me, we have a lunch appointment. Let's go to the bookshop. I was told that copies of my new book are going to appear today. I want to see if the window display is proper. He just told me about all this, you know, these modest virtues and so forth. No, Mr. Gregory Nicholas, Strauss was a member of the elite. He was a member of the elite. As to his learning, nobody could touch it.
On the rivalrous relation between students and their teachers of philosophy, I remember in Strauss's interpretation of the Memorabilia, he points out that the title of Xenophon's work might also be translated as Memories of Resentment. Did you see that at work in some of Strauss's students?
I saw it more in Strauss than I did in his students.
Resentment towards...
their general status in life.
Towards his students or towards those whom Strauss learned from?
No, I think the largest category of Strauss's students consisted in people who were at once hypnotized by him and took refuge, you know, underneath his coat, underneath his coattails, to promulgate the following view. I, of course, know nothing, but Strauss knows everything, and I'm Strauss's student, and therefore I'm in on the secret. I mean, you know, what is the mystery of esotericism? Well, we touched on that before. There's no mystery at all. You live for a certain number of years, and then you die. You know, those things vary from one person to another. There's no set of universal principles.
Was one element of the relation of Strauss's students to Strauss one of resentment because of Strauss's superiority, his mastery?
That was true at the level of his colleagues, his students. I just never knew. I mean, you know, it's struck dumb by your formulation. I never knew of anybody who envied Strauss. Could be because they believed that they were already equal to Strauss, however they got to that exalted position. Maybe one reason why philosophers are talking so much about moderation, prudence, temperance, modesty, is because they don't have any of those qualities.
Is there a way that it makes sense to speak of Straussians? And if so, what would that be? It sounds as though you almost use it as a term for second-raters, those who study with Strauss but never became independent on their own.
Yeah, I think that's what I was doing. Straussianism has come to mean something in the public domain, which I'm not part of. And that thing has nothing to do with rule and the rest. So if I use the word Straussian in quotation marks, in other words, I use it as a joke. Because the very notion of a Straussian, exactly like that of a Wittgensteinian, or a Kantian, or a Husserlian, all amount to the same thing from the standpoint of the present discussion. They mean someone who subordinates his thinking to somebody else, and who will not listen to reason or will refuse to regard as reasonable any criticisms that are made of his master, and so on. That's what I mean by Straussian. It clearly can't be the case that I think that anybody who uses the word Strauss in a friendly way is an enemy of Strauss. That'd be the exact reverse of what my view is. I don't like to be categorized, especially by people who don't know anything about me from Adam.
Let me push you just one more time about the Straussian, the phenomena of Straussians. During his lifetime, Strauss could see that there were those who called themselves Straussians. Do you think this is something that he wanted to have emerged? He wanted to have a school or a movement grow out of his teaching?
Yeah, for political reasons. I mean, his official philosophical doctrine was a kind of Socratic skepticism. There's a lot of talk about the ideas, but there's very little illumination. I mean, if one is suspicious and has been positively influenced by Strauss, then as soon as one sees that there's no doctrine of ideas, one should begin to rethink the whole thing. The whole thing loses its chastity. And then we get down to the really nitty-gritty. Does that make any sense to you?
That if there's no metaphysics behind a quote-unquote Straussian school, then there's no basis for the school. That's how I'll reformulate what you just said.
Right. The really interesting thing is that we can function without a basis. It's all very well to say that there's a clear difference between evil and morality and intelligence and stupidity and so on and so forth. Why is it true that we should live a good life and regard that as a philosophical accomplishment. We should be living a good life if and only if life is good. If it's not good, then, you know, get the hints.
I'd like to ask you to reformulate this one more time, that Strauss wanted there to be a school for political reasons. What does that mean? Because people get wide understandings of what that word political means, widely different understanding.
You mean that why is it the case for Strauss?
That for political reasons he wanted there to be Straussians. What were those political reasons? What was he attempting to do?
Make the world free from modern philosophy departments. He wanted to make the world safe for philosophy. And by the way, I kept meaning to say this, and it disappeared in the discussion. You really can't understand Strauss unless you have a good knowledge of two other people. And those guys were Klein, Jacob Klein, mm-hmm. and Alexander Kojève. Because what was Kojève's problem? What was Kojève's enterprise?
You were saying that Strauss wanted to make the world safe for philosophy.
Right, well, so did Kojève. I was sitting in Kojève's office one day, and I started laughing, and he says, "What's so funny?" I said, "You sound just like Strauss. Isn't it true that, first of all, you believe in the esoteric teaching? You know, I see his famous essay on Alexander of Aphrodisias. First, it's clear that you believe in the secret teaching, and your main goal is to conquer the world, to become the king of the world, the king of the universe." Now, Strauss did not wish to conquer the world, except by understanding it all. Kojève wanted to understand it, but he wanted to conquer it. From Kojève's standpoint, you're hallucinating. If you say, well, I have a following philosophical view, but it has no doctrines, and there's nobody who can really instantiate it. You know, all of these fetishist arguments. If you ask me, and you were wise to do so, the best thing to understand is that 75% of philosophy, official philosophy, is garbage. No sane people believes it, and you shouldn't either. But first of all, philosophy does not simply collapse into garbage. There's a stratum there of sobriety and healthy food, healthy nourishment. There's a stratum that keeps it going. I mean, my God, what would we have if we had no philosophy? We have to qualify that by saying this. Since most people are never going to achieve philosophy, either there's going to be something which is superior to philosophy or something that is worse than philosophy. So naturally, we want to take the one that's superior to philosophy. Well, what could that be? What's superior to philosophy? I had never had an answer to that question when I was a young man, and I'm not suggesting that I have it right now. In other words, there isn't anything that answers the fundamental human desire, which is camouflaged under the name philosophy. How can it be philosophy in the sense of the highest speeches when we don't know what the highest speeches are? We don't know what the lowest speeches are, and on and on and on in that vein.
Strauss was your supervisor, your dissertation supervisor.
Yes.
But you were in the Committee on Social Thought?
Yes.
But he was allowed to be your chair?
Yes.
I see.
Same was true of Benedetti.
Yeah. And you wrote on...
Libertatem philosophandi, freedom to philosophize. It's always mistranslated as freedom of speech, as though Spinoza was a... or Rawlsian, you know, or something like that. My dissertation was on Spinoza's argument for political freedom.
How did you arrive at your dissertation topic?
Strauss told me to write it.
Was it a good choice by him?
I don't know. I never showed it to anybody. I published an article based on the dissertation in a learned journal published in Italy. That's the last I've ever seriously looked at it. I did give a version of that talk to a conference in Yeshiva University, of all places, in New York.
Why do you think Strauss suggested that topic to you?
Because it was something I could handle. He believed in professionalism. You know, ironical, because he was so far alienated from the professional crowd. But his students had to know something. If they write about Foucault, they have to know who Foucault was. And they have to be able to say something about the physical characteristics of his work and so on. So he was surprisingly conventional. He was living in Israel at the time, in Jerusalem, of my dissertation. He received it from long distance. And I wrote a dissertation of 350 pages. By today's standards, nothing, you know, very, very small. So I wrote this and mailed it off to Israel. Strauss wrote back after a very short interval. And he said, "Dear Mr. Rosen, I could wish," I'd never forget that grammatical case that he used, "I could wish that you had written your entire dissertation in the style of the third paragraph on page 53. In the earlier versions." How's that for a condemnation from your teacher? So I went home. I mean, I can take a hint, as well as the next fellow. I went home and rewrote the dissertation in the style of paragraph 53, whatever, on page 53. I got my dissertation immediately. I didn't feel myself that I had accomplished anything wonderful. I wasn't interested in that. I wanted to graduate. I was never interested in Spinoza. For 2 years, I had to walk around the country giving lectures on something I had no interest in. And that was the end of it. As I separated myself from Strauss, I don't mean in some quarreling way, but you know, just growing up, I was able to bloom in a number of directions that most of Strauss's students could not accomplish. I once went to visit him in St. John's, and Mrs. Strauss had prepared some goodies. And I said, no, thanks, I don't want any. She pointed to Leo Strauss. You see your students, you're not feeding them properly. And he said, but look, he said, my students have come to see me, not to eat.
In your career and your turn to studying Heidegger, did you feel that you were influenced by Strauss's teaching as you...
No.
No?
When I graduated from Chicago, as I started to tell you an hour ago, Benedetti and Gildon and I would meet every Saturday to read, in English, of course, some essays by Heidegger. At that time, as far as I could discern, my sphere of knowledge was limited. Nobody else in Chicago had ever even heard of Heidegger, let alone stopped to read him. Strauss would have disapproved. He regarded us as too young or too vulnerable to this horrible monster who was the greatest thinker of the 20th century. He had a real love-hate relationship with Heidegger, and he did his best. I mean, he regarded himself as an inferior to Heidegger. He says, more specifically, Heidegger was a philosopher, whereas I am merely a professor of philosophy. Well, you can't be any more explicit than that.
You say that Strauss failed in his efforts as a teacher.
Well, only in the sense that he could never have produced a doctrinally purified doctrine of political philosophy. I mean, can you think of any examples that have succeeded?
I guess the question I would ask about his success is whether he parted a spirit of sobriety that still exists and runs counter to what you describe as the madness of Nietzsche and Heidegger, which might be described as dominant voices in the academy.
Yeah,
whether he imparted a spirit of sobriety. He did have students who might be philosophers, and they never would have had the opportunity to know what philosophy is if they hadn't had him as a teacher. So those are the two questions I'd ask about his success, just based on our conversation together tonight.
I'm trying to answer for Strauss, and I think it's fair to say that he, from the beginning, wished to have a political influence as well as a pedagogical one. But that I don't think he could have dreamed that he would have burgeoned into the kind of success in the public world as in fact happened. I mean, not known for his political influence in the American world. And I just don't think that he would have visualized that. But he did it. Unfortunately, it came out warped, which is another way of saying that he couldn't succeed. Now, am I suggesting, therefore, that we give up philosophy? No, I mean, I certainly don't mean that. But did Strauss succeed in producing a society that is better than what we had 2,000 years ago? In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I've been trying to minimize my participation in the discussion in favor of trying to communicate to you how I interacted with, how I got along with Strauss. That's mm-hmm. what you wanted to know. Well, that I can tell you that Strauss was a great teacher. In a sense, he saved me 5 years in my education. And I made some wonderful friends through the medium of Strauss and his circle. And I wouldn't have missed it for the world. Am I in favor of everything Strauss taught? No. I may very well be a modern. How's that for a shocker? I may very well be a modern. But that never, in my eyes, cheapened my feelings with or about Strauss.
After you left Chicago and you were no longer attending his classes, did you consider Strauss a friend?
Yes. I mean, obviously, in one sense, he could not be a friend because we were his students. Also, however, we were members of an outcast sect, and that brought all of us together closer. It had some bad effects, but we were a little world of our own, just intoxicated with Strauss, with being students of Strauss. I really do want to emphasize that I'm not certain that that was entirely good. But it was better than anything else around.
Let me ask you just one more question about his teaching. In the 5 or 6 years you took classes with him, does any class stand out as one that really made an impact on you?
The Statesman.
Why?
Because it was the first time that Strauss discussed in class in any detail what Plato might have meant by the doctrine of ideas. If I looked at that article today, that section of the Statesman, I might not have as high an opinion of it. But I spent another 20 years writing a book on the statesman. So if my book were not worth possessing because of Strauss's book, then there would have been no point in my writing it. Yes, The Statesman was my favorite book. And we were all enthused about it. Jobim was there, Bernardetti was there, all the big guns. Again, in my famous visit to Mr. and Mrs. Strauss, Strauss and I sat down on the couch to drink our coffee, and he said, "What are you working on?" or words to that effect. And I said, "Hegel, Hegel's Phenomenology." I was on my way towards writing my Hegel book. I said, "I'm writing a book on Hegel." Strauss said, "Please," he said, "do me a favor." He said, "Be sure that you read page 123, of especially the first part of The Phenomenology of Spirit, before you write your or publish your work." So I said, I chuckled, you know, I thought, how could he know? I mean, he didn't know I was writing. He couldn't prepare in advance. I went home and told Francois this amusing story. And then I thought, well, I might as well look at the paragraph. I looked at it, it cast a whole new light, you know, on what I was doing. Very funny.
One of the things I'm struck by in your portrait of Strauss is you as a rough American lad, Blankenhagen as a European, and Strauss is a European, but Strauss was open to things American.
That's right.
Do you think that he learned something from his American students that he would not have learned if he had the chance to stay in Europe and teach in Europe?
I, of course, cannot answer that question with assurance, but I think that in his heart he was a European. Certainly, no question about that in his youth when he was looking for a job. I don't think Strauss ever felt that he had something to learn from America. I think he preferred Europe to America at the cultural level. Now, he might say also he preferred American democracy, and, you know, hence he was idolized by the New Left. That he could easily have said, that he preferred American democracy. But did he learn anything? No.
What would you suggest I ask the next time I sit down with a former student of Strauss's about Strauss?
I think that you should certainly include the question of the relation between theory and practice, to use Aristotelian language. And that came up over and over again in our discussion.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's not by accident. I think that's the heart of the matter. I mean, we're interested in Strauss as a teacher. And we're, forgive me for saying we, but we are interested in showing Strauss's, in solving the problem or contributing to the solution of the problem, whether Strauss had a teaching, a political teaching, or whether that was all rhetorical and he just wanted to be alone with his Plato books. And then I think you should ask them, where do you stand on the ancients-moderns quarrel? I mean, that was the heart and soul of Strauss's teaching.